From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Larry Tai has written a kind of biography of Superman, a superhero, the first modern superhero, really, who's been around for some 75 years now. The story came from a scrawny, tongue-tied Jewish kid who kept getting bullied at school. Tai says Jerry Siegel wasn't popular and he wasn't strong, but he was inventive. And the character he created had everything he wanted for himself. He could run faster than a train, he could leap over skyscrapers, and he would actually get noticed by a pretty girl. Today in the program, we're telling the story of Superman, where the story came from, how it reaches deep into history, and how Superman has changed and endured. Larry Tai says each generation gets the Superman it needs and deserves. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You'd think that get-up Superman wears would go out of fashion over time. I mean, it's a pair of red briefs over blue tights. The S on the chest is cool enough in the cape, but the boots and the yellow belt? The fact is, Superman has endured as a superhero for going on 75 years now. But Larry Tai says that doesn't mean he hasn't changed with the times. Tai has written a book about Superman, and in it he says the Man of Steel has evolved more than the fruit fly. He used to be a simple crime fighter, but as the world got more complicated, so did the character and so did his villains. Tai says Superman is a Rorschach test of a particular time. He says each generation got the Superman it needed and deserved. Today in the program, Larry Tai is joining us to talk about his book, where he tells the story of Superman's creation. He also explores the history of heroes and works through the question of why we create the superheroes we do. The book is called Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. Larry Tai is a writer, a former journalist. His books include a biography of the legendary baseball pitcher Satchel Paige. He also runs the Health Coverage Fellowship. It's an organization where he trains journalists in the coverage of healthcare issues. He's currently writing a biography of Robert F. Kennedy, and he's joining us today from a studio in Boston, Massachusetts. Larry Tai, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you.
I wanted to start with, I mean, your first book was about a master manipulator, one of those pioneers in the field of public relations, Edward Bernays. Really influential in shaping public tastes on a number of different kinds of things. But you say in the book about Superman that you started thinking about Superman when you were writing about Bernays. What was the connection?
The connection was Edward Bernays helped us decide who our heroes ought to be. He took people ranging from President Calvin Coolidge to Enrico Caruso to lots of major figures in politics, in the world of arts and entertainment, and made them into national celebrities. Bernays was Sigmund Freud's nephew, right, and he essentially used his uncle's ideas on why people behave the way they do to help us reshape our behavior concerning those people, those products. And I wondered, what is it about a hero that has Americans embracing them? Are we being manipulated to care about them? Is there something in our psyche that this hero taps? And I thought the best way to understand America's embrace of heroes was to look at a guy that I think is the longest lived hero of the last century, and that's this guy named Superman.
You say Superman kind of broke a mold. I mean, there have been, you know, throughout our history, we've had heroes, and over time they would kind of fade away, but Superman seems to be sticking around. Do you think now, and we'll get into this, as, of course, as we go, do you have a better sense of why he's hung around for so long as a myth and as a character?
I do. I think it's two things. One is what you started talking about, the idea that he has over time evolved as much as the fruit fly has, that in the era when he was first put out there in the comic book, it was the New Deal era, and Superman was the ultimate New Dealer. He was going after wife beaters, after slumlords. He was the consummate FDR kind of character. And over time, as America's needs and aspirations and fears shifted, he changed. So during World War II, he helped take us to war. During the Cold War, nobody was out there fighting the Red Menace the way that Superman was. And during the Reagan era, Superman's hair got a little shorter, his politics got a little more status quo oriented, and he moved a little bit to the right. So part of it was being able to change with the times, but every bit as essential as that was that he represented a certain moral constancy. He was our best sense of what we could be, our righteousness, our values of not to kill and to believe that there was something called good out there. Mm. And so no matter how uncertain the ethics of the time or the politics of the time, Superman always was a touchstone to go back to. So he changed in superficial ways to make us continue listening to him, and yet he always represented that same constancy and a clunky familiarity that made us reassured. Mm.
You grew up when Superman was on television. You talked about how you read the comics. So were you a typical, you know, American fan, or were you a bit of a geek?
I was a bit of a typical geek, I think.
Right.
Typical in the sense that when I was growing up in the 1950s and the early 1960s, comic books and comic strips were something I loved. Mm-hmm. And as much as I loved them, I loved even more hearing Superman come on television. Every afternoon, he was there, and he was about the most popular thing on TV. And the biggest incentive when you were a little kid to finish your homework and to stay in good relations with your parents was being able to watch Superman every afternoon take off and do whatever adventures he was doing. Mm. So I loved it. The good news was my friends loved it. And as much as I was a geek, thankfully they were too, and we all watched it together.
It's funny because some of the book is about, you know, these bigger motifs about heroes and the nature of heroes and those kinds of things. But you also confess in the book that a lot of this is it just gave you an opportunity to be 10 years old again. Just the joy of the story itself.
There was a very serious part of sort of trying to look at heroes and look at all these big issues, and that was to sort of make myself feel justified. I was spending 2 years, after all, with Superman, yeah. But nothing was better than the comfort food of indulging in Superman again the way I did when I was 10, and I felt throughout this two-year process repeatedly like I was a little kid again, and that's what I was trying to do for a reader, is take them back and not just see the serious issues, but have fun with him.
Mm. Do people know the story of Superman? Not Superman, the, you know, we know that story, but do they know this backstory very well? Is it very well known as a story?
The backstory of Superman not only isn't well known, but what we thought was the backstory of Superman, we find out is actually quite a bit different. That, yeah. One of the things that I had the good fortune to stumble onto that had never been seen before was the memoir of this guy named Jerry Siegel, yeah. Who was the creator of Superman. It had never been published. Nobody had ever seen it before. And it came out as part of a legal proceeding, an ongoing legal proceeding by his heirs against the companies that own Superman. And so we really could go back and see just what it was that Jerry was thinking about in the 1930s when he dreamed up this wonderful character.
There are a number of themes that emerge when you kind of pull the story apart. First of all, you get a sense that it's, as you say in the book, it's an intrinsically simple story. It's very, very straightforward. It's pretty basic, I guess.
It is. And if I could just take you through and take your listeners through the basic backstory of what Jerry Siegel was going through, because that's really the story of Superman. And we had in the 1930s this kid, he was the youngest of six Lithuanian immigrant kids living in a very poor and very Jewish part of Cleveland, Ohio, called Glenville. Mm. And he was getting along just fine until one day his dad owned a used clothing store in a relatively seedy part of town. And one day, three guys came in and tried on a suit and then walked out without paying for it. And Jerry's dad, in the process of trying to stop them, had a massive heart attack. And he never even made it to the hospital. And suddenly this kid is bereft. He's lost his role model. He's lost his dad. And this is a kid who every day on the school ground was a bit tormented. He was a bit shorter and rounder than he would have liked to have been. He wore glasses, and his buddies on the playground would tease him. They would yell, "Siegel, Siegel, birds of an eagle." Mm. And he wished that he could fly away, and he wished that the girls hadn't heard what had happened to him. So he was started out feeling a bit put upon, and then he loses his dad, and he retreats into a fantasy world. Every night when he goes to bed, he brings a pencil and a pad of paper with him to bed, and he starts scribbling out stories. And eventually, he starts out with a story of a character that he calls Superman, S-U-P-E-R hyphen capital M-A-N. And it's an evil character who's trying to take over the world. And over time, Jerry is smart enough to realize that the kind of story that's going to resonate and the kind of hero that he wants for himself is not an evil character. So he drops the hyphen and he drops the bad guy, and he ends up in the first story that we ever see that was illustrated of this Superman. He ends up with Superman coming in and saving a guy who looks an awful lot like Jerry's dad, who's being held up by robbers. Mm. And basically, Superman is doing what Jerry couldn't do. He was there and could help out a guy like Jerry's dad. And so we see that this story that's lasted now 74 years, starts out as a wonderfully simple story of a little boy who needs a hero.
So the robbery, which happens in June of 1932, as you write about in the book, it kind of gives us sort of clarity to Jerry's fantasy world. It's interesting, though, the stories that he was creating. I mean, you talked about in the book how he loved parody. He loved to invent these funny characters in these fantasies. So he had a kind of sense of humor. And it seemed Jerry had a kind of sense of irony in here, too. They didn't seem overly simplistic. They seemed complicated in some ways.
You're exactly right. He had a sense of humor. He had a sense of irony. And yet when he went to this Superman story, he understood he was drawing on all the things that had come before him. This was a kid who was very much into popular culture at his time. Mm. So he had read everything from Doc Savage to The Adventures of the Phantom. He was familiar through his Sunday school with great heroes like Samson. He understood a little bit about Greek mythology, and he was drawing elements of all of this. And he understood that his ultimate story, he was going to drop the humor, and he was going to only hold on to bits of the irony. And he really wanted to create something that was not just bigger than any of that, but that showed people, if people like these girls on the playground and these boys who were taunting him, he wanted them to understand that if they could see inside of him, they would see beyond this mild-mannered, bespectacled kid lay a Superman. And that was the story he was trying to tell us, that within all of us, and that I think is the nerve that he tapped brilliantly, within all of us, if only people could see it, there's something more noble and more strong.
I want to ask you a little bit more about those really ancient themes of the Superman story. I mean, you talk about the DNA of the figure of a Superman traces back some 2,500 years. You mentioned the Hebrew Bible that Jerry would have been familiar with, the story of the character of Samson, the Hellenists. You say the Greeks were great at creating these superheroes. In fact, that's where we get the word, the name, hero. What are we seeing in the elements of those stories? Why are we creating these figures? Again, is it for the same reason Jerry was, to make sense of something bad that was happening, to find someone that was supernatural, that had powers? What was going on, do you think?
I think two things were going on. I think that you're raising interesting points. Part of what we were looking for is we were looking for something that was bigger than all of us that we could believe in, a heroic figure, a godlike figure, a really strong figure. But we were looking for something that was more than just out there and something to maybe be in awe of. We were looking for something that also gave us a sense of personal empowerment in ourselves. So there was something about this dual identity that Jerry created that I think captured it brilliantly. It wasn't just a Samson or a Hercules who was somebody that we were never going to be able to live up to, but it was a Superman paired with a Clark Kent. Mm. It was us, and it was somehow suggesting that we could tap in ourselves this sense of superpowers, super brain, sort of super heroism that was not just something outside of us, but was within us.
Let me read an email. It comes from a professor, Jeremy Brown, sent it to earlier today. He makes this point, about, and you do as well in the book, and he writes that he's intrigued by this idea that Superman was somehow original. He writes, "It seems to me that every superhero with an alter ego is a copy of Zorro, who himself was inspired by the Scarlet Pimpernel." And he says these distinctions and similarities are just details. He talks about Beowulf and Achilles and Hercules and Gilgamesh. And he says, despite their superhuman qualities, superhero lore seems oddly human. So it seems that Superman, or our appreciation of Superman, is a fitting tribute to America. We hold him as such an ideal, so original, when in fact there have been plenty of others like him. He's got a point, I guess, right? I mean, this goes back.
He's absolutely got a point, and there's no question, and Jerry would never have denied, that he was drawing on things that came before. We've always need this sense of myth. But the question is, the challenge to me in this book was partly understanding his roots, but also understanding why Zorro and Robin Hood and other characters have sort of faded away, and Superman is as strong as he was 74 years ago in our popular imagination. And what was it that was unique about him that allowed him to last when Zorro didn't? Mm.
It's the American dynamic also that plays into this as well. I mean, that's what the book is about in many ways as well. What makes Superman decidedly American?
It's hugely about the American dynamic. And so we have Jerry Siegel, who in the early 1930s has created this wonderful fantasy character. But we also have the idea of what America was going through and what America needed at the same moment. And I think that I would argue never in the modern history of publishing have we had a more perfect coincidence between a character and a country's need for that character. That it was in America in those 1930s that was becoming immersed in the Great Depression. We were on the eve of joining into World War II, and we needed a heroic figure at the same time that this little boy in Cleveland, Ohio, needed his own personal hero, and his hero happened to hit the comic book stands at the very moment that America was ready to embrace him.
You also mention in your book the other kind of literary figures who've created their own kind of superheroes. Voltaire, who creates this 120,000-foot-tall super genius. And then, of course, there's Victor Frankenstein and his monster, Mary Shelley's creation, which I think raises a really interesting question that you write about. Jerry Siegel, you say, kind of vacillated between super-man and Superman. This question being, should his protagonist be a villain? Should he be, you know, what he became, this unwavering, stalwart hero? Or should it be something in between, you know, something more, as you say in the book, more ambiguous, like Dr. Frankenstein? Talk about that, if you would, because it's interesting. Right now, we just figure that's what you would create, is this unwavering hero who had all these superpowers. But Jerry Siegel was thinking in more complicated ways. He was more ambivalent in some ways about this hero, it seems, at first.
He was. And I think the hero he ended up with ended up being just the right hero for our times back then and for our times today. We have all kinds of models for superheroes out there now who combine the ambiguity that you were just alluding to. Mm. We have Spider-Man, who is a totally anxious and fraught hero. And we have Batman, who has this dark side and sort of starts with revenge and vengeance as part of his defining motif. And I think that lots of people came in and filled in the void that Jerry Siegel had left, maybe intentionally, as he moved to sort of this pure and more righteous hero. But the fact is that no matter how simple it seems at times, and no matter how sort of Dudley, do-right, and nerdy it seems at times, we still go back to this hero of light at a moment we've got plenty of darkness and plenty of anxiety in our world. And I think the reason Superman continues to tower above everybody is because of just what Jerry tapped into in the end, which is we really do want the good guy, and we really do want that positive role model.
Larry Tye is with us. His book is Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio.
Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Superman. Superman has been around for 75 years now, and from time to time he gets a touch-up and he changes, but he's the most enduring of the superheroes, and the journalist Larry Tye says there's a reason for that. Today in the program, Tye is joining us. He's written a kind of biography of Superman, if you will, which tells the story of his creation and also gets at the question of why we create the heroes we do. I wanted to talk about some of the themes that come up when you're looking at the story of the creation of Superman. One remarkable theme, I have to say, and it hadn't occurred to me, was this idea of just how many of those involved in the creation of Superman didn't have the influence of their father.
Absolutely. We started out with Jerry Siegel, who had lost his father during that robbery. The guy who was one of the founders of DC Comics and was the driving force behind getting Superman published was a guy who lost his father at a very young age, a guy named Jack Liebowitz. Mm. The guy who brought Superman to television and to the radio was a guy named Robert Maxwell, who had lost his father at a young age. The guy who played Superman for the first time, and for your older listeners, they'll remember George Reeves as being the first TV Superman. Yeah. And he never knew who his father was. His father died when, or he thought he died when he was young, and he went through most of his childhood not knowing who his real father was. And I think that there was something going on there, that these people who were giving us this hero, this father replacement figure, was in fact a story that they had played out in their own lives, and it made it compelling for them. They didn't have to go back and dream about this. They needed a hero themselves. And it was part of, to me, this notion of these bereft young men going around looking for a personal hero gives to me sort of flesh and bones to why the Superman story continued to tap into a nerve and give us just the kind of hero that we needed.
You write about there being this kind of structure or pattern in the stories. Oliver Twist, Little Orphan Annie, these foundling tales. That's another theme here, right?
All of these are themes that tap into our psyche. So what better foundling? We loved Little Orphan Annie. We loved Oliver Twist. But what better foundling could we have than this super foundling who came from not just another environment, but another entire planet, yeah, and who came to a world where he knew nobody. And it was just, there was something about all of these things that tapped into something universal about our myths. He was strong. He could do the things, not just things like having X-ray vision and super hearing, but the coolest things of all, if there's any power that all of us as a kid dream about, it's the power to fly away. And Superman could do everything that we would love to be able to do ourselves. He also could do just what Clark Kent couldn't do, which was he could get the girl. He was just tapping into everything that we dreamed about doing, which is why he continues to tap into our imagination enough that we'll go watch him in the movie theater, we'll read his graphic novels, and we'll even watch him on TV.
Let's go to the phones. Fred is joining us from Salt Lake.
Hi there. Thank you very much. And thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My name is Fred, and I'm the Rabbi Emeritus of the synagogue here in Salt Lake City. And I'd like you to comment, if you would, about a lot of literature that I've been seeing lately about Superman and the American Jewish experience. I remember an article I read a while ago that apparently Jerry Siegel drew on the legend of the Golem of Prague, kind of merged it in with the Samson legend, and then talked about his own family background.
Sure, I'd love to. That I want to tell your listeners that I didn't set up that question, but I'm sure glad to have it, because there are two aspects to the Jewish experience that tie into the Superman story. One is the idea that all the comic book, the early smart comic book creators, the people who gave us everybody from Spider-Man to Batman to Superman, were Jews themselves. And what they were writing about was what they needed in their world. And I think what we needed, what American Jews like Jerry Siegel and his drawing buddy, the guy who sketched the early Superman comic books, Joe Shuster, what they needed at that moment when we had an Adolf Hitler in the world, we needed a sense of Jewish strength and ability to sort of fight back, and whether it was drawing on the ancient golem legend from hundreds of years before, or whether it was drawing on this guy who was quite famous in Europe at that time, named Zygmunt Breitbart, who was a Jewish strongman. I think that Jews were trying to create characters who could give them a sense of empowerment. And it was not by accident that one of the earliest villains Superman took on in his very early years, long before America took him on, was Adolf Hitler. But I think there was something else going on. There was a dimension of the Superman story that it wasn't just his creators who were Jewish. I would argue, and I do argue in my book, that Superman himself was Jewish.
Yeah.
And let me explain why. So when he comes down from the planet Krypton, he comes down with the name Kal-El. And as Rabbi Fred would know, and as all your listeners who might speak Hebrew would know, Kal-El in Hebrew roughly translates into a vessel of God. And I think that was not accidental. I think it was not accidental that the Superman story mirrors, better than anything I can think of, the Old Testament story of Exodus. It was parents, in order to save their child, floating them, in this case in outer space, in the Exodus story, in a river, and two Gentiles, in this case John and Martha Kent, find the baby floating down to them on Earth and adopt him as their own, and slowly begin to realize that this is a very special child that they have found. And we could go on and talk about how all the biblical notions of the world sort of falling apart and it being a human responsibility to help repair the world are precisely what Superman was doing. But if we needed one last fun piece of evidence, I would defy you to come up with many people whose name ends with the letters M-A-N, man, who either isn't a superhero or isn't Jewish. Now, the fact that I claim Superman is Jewish hasn't stopped Christians over the years from claiming that he's the Christ story, that God sends his son to earth to try to save mankind by showing them how good they could be. And Buddhists think of Superman as the ultimate Zen-like figure. And agnostics say, but oh, he's the perfect secular Messiah.
Right.
I think that Superman is such a universal hero that we all want to adopt him as ours.
Rabbi Wenger, thanks very much for the time.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Well, we've talked about Jerry Siegel. I want to talk a bit about Joe Shuster, another great character. He's an illustrator. You say not necessarily a brilliant artist, I guess, inspired, but not necessarily visionary. He comes to do the first drawings of a Superman figure. Tell us about Joe Shuster.
Sure. So the way Jerry Siegel tells the story, and the story became a little more dramatic every time he told it, the way he tells it is that one night when he finally pulled it all together with his scratch pad and his pencil after he had gone to bed, he wakes up the next morning with the full story assembled on his head and much of it on his sheet of paper, and he runs down the street to his buddy Joe Shuster's house, and Joe draws what Superman ought to look like. And he draws it partly by what Jerry has imagined him as, and he draws it partly by looking in the mirror and imagining himself as Clark Kent and the superhero he sees in himself. And on the one hand, if you were to look at it and you were sort of to take this into an art class, people would say, geez, the lines were awfully rough, and this was a very sort of crude sketch. On the other hand, I think it was powerful, and it was crude in the same way that Jerry's earliest stories were. You could either call them crude or elemental, and I think his drawing was wonderfully elemental. It was something that kids could relate to. It was a character who had enough definition that we could really see him on paper and in our own mind. And he was really, like Jerry, a young teenage kid, grew up in Jewish, poor Glenville section of Cleveland, didn't have much of a sense of the world, but had enough inspiration that he could translate Jerry's words into pictures in a way that really worked brilliantly. And I defy anybody to go back and look in 1938 in an issue stamped June 1938, the first issue of Superman, and not be inspired that this was a character, this was a hero that you wanted as your hero.
What do we understand about the tights and the red, the colors, and the boots? What was there some significance in there, or did they just look cool?
So we start out with the fact that they looked really cool.
Yeah.
And they also suggested a certain confidence. Anybody who was confident enough to wear their underpants over their tights right. and sort of show themselves to the world in that way had to either combine somehow an innocence and a confidence that was just wonderful. But these were the elemental colors. We're talking about red and blue and yellow, and these were just, they had vibrancy, they had power. And the uniform, like so many other things, slowly and subtly evolved over time. But they captured again, whether it was by accident or by brilliance, a certain wonderful elemental quality. But there's something else. And you mentioned earlier a professor who had written in talking about Superman being partly derived from images like Zorro. Yeah. There was something really essential about Superman and his uniform that lots of the other heroes didn't have. And that was that Superman, unlike Batman or Spider-Man or Zorro, didn't wear a mask. Seeing who he was really part of the idea that he had nothing to hide. He was there bearing himself to the world. There was also something that distinguished him from just about every other one of the superheroes who came before or came after, which is that his real identity was Superman and his disguise was his human identity. As we all know, Batman was really Bruce Wayne disguised as Batman. Peter Parker was the real character, and Spider-Man was his disguise. With Superman, it was the reverse. And I think what that was saying was that here was a true superhero. He didn't have to pretend to be anything, but he was striving so hard to find his humanity after he came to Earth that he disguised himself as a human and really tried to understand how to be mild-mannered and how to blend in. Mm. And it was turning on its head in a way that I think worked brilliantly, the normal formula for a superhero.
Let's go to the phones again. Corey is joining us in Provo. Corey, is this the point you were getting at?
That's correct. You know, just like every other superhero, you had Peter Parker, you had Bruce Wayne, and everybody else, and their secret identity was, you know, Batman and Spider-Man versus Superman. Stands out from the rest. He was Superman, and his secret identity was Clark Kent, and his impression of what a human person was. But for him, it was just a bumbling type of character who always messed up in things and to, you know, try to...
Get the girl.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it. Yeah. Yeah, that's the point, I guess, right, Larry Tye? I mean, that's...
It is.
Yeah.
So, Corey and Doug, I don't know you well enough to know what you're like, but the I'm definitely the bumbling Clark Kent looking for the Superman in me, and that's what Jerry and Joe were, and that's why we can relate to them, that we understand we're willing to wink with them, whether it's on TV or in the comic books or in the movies, when all Clark Kent really does is sort of takes off his glasses and puts on a costume and doesn't really change his appearance. And we're willing to go along with that and the fact that he didn't have to do much to change his look because that's who we are. And we really, it is the people talk about him being this great superhero who is so righteous that we can't relate to him and we need the fraught Batman and Spider-Man types. I think that Superman is incredibly easy to relate to because we're all the bumbling Clark Kent trying to be Superman.
Mm. I love the story you tell in the book where Jerry poses for Joe to give him a sense of Clark Kent and how Joe poses for himself, really, to get a sense of the Clark Kent figure or of the Superman figure. You say he contorts his face to look enraged and beaming with self-satisfaction.
You're exactly right, Doug. And in fact, both of them thought that they were really the Clark Kent and that that was who Joe was drawing.
Right.
And we all think it's us. And yeah. I just came back from a crazy place this past weekend called Metropolis, Illinois, where they had a 30,000-person Superman festival. And everybody I met there thought that they were Clark Kent.
Let's go back to the phones. Josh is with us in West Valley City. Josh, hi.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to comment a little bit more on what you guys were saying earlier about how Superman tends to see things more in black and white. And some of my favorite interactions with other heroes that he had in the comics was especially with Batman, where they see things a little bit more gray. And I was going to say, if they vote, I'll bet Superman's a conservative voter and Batman's probably more democratic or independent.
Well, that's interesting, because I have to say, Larry Tye, that's what you're saying, is what the appeal is. No matter, for all the talk we say of wanting more complicated figures, that's why he's endured, is because he's someone we can rely on. There aren't many gray areas with this figure.
There aren't. In his, I would agree with the caller in terms of him being much more black and white, and that a lot of people, the gray is more appealing, but I think when we're really in a crunch time, having the black and white sense is really great, that the world has plenty of gray in it and plenty of things we have to muddle through, and getting a clear sense is really wonderful. In terms of Superman's politics, the only thing I would disagree is that he started out as more left-leaning and more of a at least liberal, if not a leftist, than even Batman did, and over time he's gone back and forth. And we tend to think of this sort of more black and white as more politically conservative, but Superman, depending on who was writing him, one of the wonderful things is that over the years, writers have partly given us their own sense of Superman based on their own politics and who they were, and they've partly given us a Superman that they think we want at that moment. And yet, if they go too far in either direction, there's something about the character that almost seems to have his own internal strength after 74 years that he and his owners pull them back to something true to who Jerry created in the first place.
Larry Tye is with us. His book is called Superman: The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. We're going to take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist and writer Larry Tye. We're talking about his book, Superman: The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. I wanted to talk about the death of Superman, which you write about. You talk about how the idea, it wasn't the first time it had come up, but the idea that eventually really kills Superman, I guess, starts as a joke. At the summit, it's 1991, a fellow by the name of Jerry Ordway says, "Let's kill him," and he's not joking.
Right. So, this was a summit. I want to take you to this summit room, and it's sort of like all the summits over 74 years of trying to figure out new ways to go with a character while keeping him true to himself and his history. And they thought they were about to get Superman married, but there was a problem. There was a new TV show out there called Lois and Clark. And Superman's handlers at Warner Brothers and Time Warner wanted to have the marriage happen on the air on TV. So these guys in the comic books, who had been all excited about taking Superman and getting him married, realized that they had to come up with a new way of going. And Jerry Ordway, at every one of these summits for years, had just been jokingly yelling out from the back of the room, "Hey, let's kill him." And suddenly, stuck for an idea, somebody said, "Hey, let's kill him."
Yeah.
And they decided that they were going to do this, that they decided that they could build it up into something that Superman could take on his most loathsome enemy ever, and that maybe he would actually die. And so they played it out over a whole series of comic books. They actually gave out a special edition of the comic book that was wrapped in plastic and that had blood dripping and the red paint dripping that looked like it was blood and Superman was really dying at the hands of a monster named Doomsday. And it was quite extraordinary. And it sold, eventually, with reprints and everything, 6 million issues, the biggest single-day sale of a comic book ever. And it was really amazing. There were a couple small glitches. One was that nobody had told the bosses at Warner Brothers what was going to happen. And they were actually, in one of the publications that was advertising Superman, they were running a battery ad for, do you remember the old Duracell battery ads where the bunny would go forever?
Oh, yeah.
And the bunny, like Superman, was supposed to go forever. And it didn't work brilliantly to have Superman advertising Duracell batteries when Superman was dying. Not exactly the image the battery maker wanted. And so the higher-ups were a bit upset that they had been caught off guard, and they thought, what are you doing? How can you kill our premier character in all of the things that we own? There's nobody who's been around longer and matters more than Superman. And the problem was that whether it was the editorial writers at the New York Times who wrote about it, or the higher-ups at Warner Brothers, or lots of other people who actually wrote threatening letters to the people at DC Comics, they didn't understand that the comic books could kill a character and bring him back to life all in the course of a couple months, and that no way was Superman ever going to go away forever. So, very traumatic. He dies. There were a million page one stories and editorials in newspapers all across the world. DC Comics gets record sales. It gets record publicity. And then it has a whole series of potentially new Superman that it was going to bring back. It tested them out in series of different comic books. There was the Cyber Superman, and there was Superboy, a new creation of Superman. And, of course, the Superman they ended up with was the tried-and-true Superman who had been around for 60, however many years at that point, and they brought back the hero we loved. And anybody who really knew the history of comic books would know that Superman had been killed off and brought back to life repeatedly over the 60 years before that.
Yeah. 57, 58, 61, 62, 63, 66, 68, 84, twice in 1987.
Incredible.
It's amazing. 1950, he became terminally ill.
Absolutely. And saved by the X Factor.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. Rich is with us in Troy, Alabama. Rich, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? I've been enjoying listening to you on my lunch hour. Something I've been thinking about for, got to be 30-odd, 40 years. You know, Lois Lane, and you alluded to some of this earlier, Lois Lane has, in the comic strip with Perry White, she was a crack investigative reporter for the Daily Planet. And also the newspaper in Metropolis, Illinois is known as the Planet. It's not a daily. It only comes out once a week, and they have a big mural of Superman on their water tower. But anyway, I've often thought, how smart could Lois be? The only clue she has that Superman and Clark are not the same person is, gee, Clark, how come you always disappear when Superman arrives?
And what about those glasses?
Well, no, I have glasses, and I tried this with my friends. I take off my glasses, and you know they still recognize me?
Yeah,
but and then I thought, we're not giving Lois enough credit, or we're not looking at ourselves enough, because then I realized later that although I've never seen Santa Claus and the Jolly Green Giant together, it only took me until recently to figure out that they're the same person.
Larry Ty, what do you make of that? It's such a good question. You hear it all the time, I'm sure. What are we suspending? Are we just supposed to suspend some sense of belief or something? What about it?
Well, I love that question partly because it was a brilliant Superman comic book sometime in the 1970s, I think. And we actually have a picture of that in the book where basically Clark on the cover is saying exactly what your caller just said. He's saying, I'm not going to marry you, Lois, or you, Lana, if you're both so dumb not to recognize for all these years that Clark and I are the same person. And then they came up with, in the 1960s, when they were doing a series of what they call special imaginary stories, they came up with an explanation that there was something about Superman's glasses that hypnotized all of the readers and viewers into thinking that he was different and that there was really more of a physical difference between he and Superman. But one of the wonderful things is when I was in this last weekend, Metropolis, Illinois, I was talking to Lois Lane, who was a woman named Noelle Neal, who is 92 years old now and is very frail, but was my vision of what Lois Lane looked like in the first days of the Superman on the air. She was the original Superman in the movie serials, and after the first year, she was a Superman next to George Reeves in all of those TV Adventures of Superman. And I've talked to her when I interviewed her for the book, and when I saw her this past weekend, I asked her about that. And basically what she said is that one of the wonderful things that we talked about earlier is that whether it was adults or kids or grandparents who were watching the TV show, they all wanted to believe enough that they were willing to suspend belief. Mm-hmm. And there was never a Superman who did less to change his appearance from Clark to Superman than her Superman, George Reeves. And yet we loved him enough that we were willing to go along with anything. And it was almost like he was winking at his TV viewers and saying, you know, you and I know who I really am, and let's play the game.
Rich, thanks. So, of course, there have been so many different versions or images of Superman. I wanted to ask you about one in particular you write about, Alex Ross, a rendering you write about from a collection in, I think it was 1999, Peace on Earth. Mm-hmm. It's a different image in many ways, maybe a more complicated image of Superman.
So it's the antithesis. I'm sitting here looking at the image you're talking about right now, and it's the antithesis of the Joe Shuster image. Mm-hmm. Joe Shuster's characters of Superman and Clark and all the rest were almost, by comparison, stick-like figures that didn't have much that we could look at and sort of see into their soul and into their personality. The Superman that Alex Ross drew is one who's sitting there in a chair with his white shirt, his Clark Kent shirt, still on. He's sitting there with his Superman uniform on underneath that, and he's looking down with his glasses on pensively. And we get a sense, I've always wondered, what is Superman like when he goes home and lies down on the couch? Does he think of himself as Clark Kent or as Superman or as something in between? Mm. And this image wonderfully says that here's a guy who is incredibly thoughtful, who partly sees himself as a human version Clark Kent, but knows underneath he's Superman, and he's having this wonderful moment of quiet and solitude, and yet we can look in his face and we can see his soul there. And it is part of the evolution by the writers and by the artists that have taken us the full arc of the history of the last 74 years. Superman, to me, is a perfect lens into seeing American popular culture and how it has changed over 75 years. And in that story, Peace on Earth, we see the arc of the writing and how it's become a whole lot different and more nuanced, and the art of the art.
You know, you wonder in the book, you know, and you ask the question, will the 20th century's longest lasting hero endure in this new century, this new millennium? And you say it really depends on, in part, on those who are telling the story.
It depends on two things, three things, actually. One, it depends on a lawsuit that's going on now with the heirs of Jerry Siegel and soon to be joined by the heirs of Joe Shuster, suing Time Warner and DC Comics to try to reclaim the rights to the character that Jerry and Joe sold in 1938 for a total of $130. So this character that's earned billions of dollars, they sold for $130. Mm. Now, in fairness to Time Warner, Jerry and Joe and their heirs had been collecting very generous settlements over the years, but they want to claim back some of the original rights. And that lawsuit requires a judge who has the wisdom of Solomon to realize you can't tear this character apart and parse out parts to Jerry and Joe's heirs and parts to Time Warner. So number one, we've got to get through the lawsuit, and I think we will get through that and we'll have a settlement. Number two, we depend on the writers and the artists to continue giving us a character that we find compelling. And they've been doing it for 74 years. They're about to, yesterday, DC and Warner Brothers came out with a new animated Superman film. Next summer, a live-action blockbuster. Mm-hmm. So I don't worry about the lawsuit. I don't worry about the artists and writers. And number three is, Doug, you and me and everybody who's listening today, we continue to have to find ourselves in need of a hero that we can embrace and that helps us understand our lives and give us a little escape from the real world. And I think I really worry most of all if we ever run out of the need for a hero and the willingness to escape reality and spend a little time in fantasy, then I worry about the state of humanity.
Mm. So you think we need one? We need a champion, right?
Especially, I think it's 74 years and counting, and we'll be back. I hope you'll have me on in another 74 years
okay.
to talk about the third one.
Right. Let me ask you finally, what's your favorite version of Superman? Your favorite? I mean, there have been so many different images. They've all been similar in many ways. But do you have a favorite? Is it that Alex Ross one, or is there another one?
So I think everybody's favorite is the first one that they really fell in love with. Yeah. And for me, it was George Reeves on TV. He was clunky. He was a bit too sort of manlike and less human. And yet he was, when I think of Superman today and close my eyes, it's George Reeves that I see.
Larry Tighe, his book is called Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. He joined us today from a studio in Boston, Massachusetts. Larry Tighe, thanks very much for the time.
Wonderful to be with you today.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our thanks to Matthew Martin. Radio West is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.